Hey, I'm Abigail Johnson, and you're listening to the Tennis in the UK podcast. Hello, hello, hello. It was a big British weekend this past weekend, and not for the reasons you think. It was a clean sweep of British winners at Nottingham Tennis Centre last week, bringing a conclusion to the three straight weeks of M25 and W25 level ITF events, which were being staged in succession at that venue. What a conclusion! On this episode of the podcast, we'll be hearing from two of the weekend's champions, the only champions to feature in an all-GB final showdown. So on this occasion, that was not week one winners Maya Lumsden and Nathan Baines, who were victorious again, winning their third doubles title in as many weeks with a 4-6, 6-4, 10-6 defeat of Jiajing Lu and Elena Malagina in the week three final. This was just a few days after claiming a W40 title in France. So they are on a serious roll right now. Neither was it Harriet Dart, who was ranked inside the world's top 100 as recently as January and backed up her own top seed status by winning the women's singles title in Nottingham without dropping a set. Dart's run was doubly impressive as it featured a semi-final victory over Arina Rodionova, who was on a 13-match win streak. In the men's singles, 22-year-old George Lofhagen was unseeded but still claimed his second M25 singles trophy in just over a month with a 7-6, 6-2 defeat of French number 6 seed Jules Marie. Marie had beaten him twice this season, including during his week one title run in Nottingham. So that was a big victory for Lofhagen in the title match. And we will hopefully be hearing from George on the podcast in future to get a little bit more insight into his journey to date. But this week, you're hearing from the week three M25 Nottingham doubles champions, 32-year-old Marcus Willis and 28-year-old Scott Duncan. Seeded number two, they combined to win their sixth trophy as a duo and did so by winning 8 sets out of 8 contested last week. All of their team titles have been won within the past 9 months, so since September 2022, and the latest was sealed with a 6-3, 6-2 defeat of Team Bath's Giles Hussey and Ben Jones in the final. Great Britain is churning out strong doubles teams these days. At the end of last season, we heard from a couple of those, namely Lissy Barnett and Liv Nichols, and Henry Patton and Julian Cash. And as Marcus and Scott race towards the world's top 200, they are right in the mix right now. The two of them are straight back onto the match court in Spain this week, but they were good enough to take the best part of an hour to discuss everything from their partnership to date, to experiences of missed flights, to the completely accurate story of why Scott abandoned Marcus during week one of Nottingham. So for the next 45 minutes, here are Marcus Willis and Scott Duncan.
Marcus and Scott, recently in Nottingham, but now in Spain, after a successful week in Nottingham, where you went to the trophy in week three. So that's a good starting point. We didn't have a long time to discuss that one because Marcus was on the way to catch a flight that he never caught, which was quite sad. But guys, what was your assessment of your week going to the trophy last week?
Obviously very happy to win. But our performances were good, actually. We won every match in the straight. Every match was tough, which it is in Britain. Normally, the doubles are still pretty good, so... we were happy to perform as well as we did. We lost first round, second week in a match tie break. So to bounce back like that's pretty good. Yeah, what we say to each other each week is try and get to our seeding. So if we're 4 seeds, or we'll try and make semis and beyond. Obviously, we try and win everything. But being 2nd seeds, we made the final, which was a good week in itself. And then we managed to play a very good match and win that one as well.
Yeah, the logic is if we keep the points sort of ticking over, then the ranking's going to go up. We're going to get into better tournaments and, you know, that's the logic.
Yeah, I mean, it's good logic. What aspects of your games were you most pleased with in the most recent week of Nottingham?
For me, my returning. I felt my returning's been off sort of the last couple of weeks. We've had a bit of a discussion about what we thought that might have been. I was sort of in the middle of changing rackets, and I think we've just gone back to the old racket for the time being. Which, like, it's a weird thing to say because it's like some people say, that's not like superstition, but it maybe doesn't mean that much. But I don't know, it was probably one like quite a good thing, because we did speak about it, and it's sometimes you can be a bit stubborn with it and maybe think you can persevere through it, but it's just a different racket, has a different feel. So that helped me, and I just like the confidence that came just because I felt like I knew exactly what was happening was just a lot better, and it helped us settle into matches, I thought. That's from my perspective.
Yeah, I mean, definitely he got this new racket, which is nice, but it plays very differently. Certainly from my perspective, seeing the returns, wasn't returning poorly. There just wasn't as much conviction on it, and I think the new racket he had a lot. It's basically for spin players. So there's a lot more spin on the returns, but not as much, I don't know, penetration, I suppose. We weren't getting into games on the return as much. We're 30 love down very, very quickly a lot of the time. And obviously I'm always thinking what we can do better, win or lose. And for Scott, since he changed to that racket, he just wasn't returning as well. I also wasn't serving as well, so I did a little bit of work with my serve, my friend Charlie, before week one in Nottingham, because serve's something I've never had to really think about. But from January this year, it wasn't bad, but it's been pretty average. And so I was really happy with the way I served. Actually, all three Nottingham games I thought served really well. We just lost a really tight one second week. But yeah, so that's what we've been working on ourselves, as well as obviously, you know, all the volleys and positioning and stuff like that. But personally, yeah, for me, it's the serve.
Yeah, that's great stuff. Strong serve on Marcus' side, strong return on Scott's side. So that's a good combo. You mentioned, Marcus, 3 weeks in Nottingham, because you did play week one and you won the trophy, but with Neil Oberleitner, not with Scott.
Yeah.
Scott, this is your moment, because we've all been dragging you for a couple of weeks. I first heard the story of why you weren't around in week one from Marcus. I quite enjoyed Marcus' version. There were a couple of things in there that I think you will tell me differently that I actually preferred from the Willis story, because I heard you went to see Mamma Mia, which I kind of liked that idea. It wasn't quite Mamma Mia. So, Scott, this is it. You've got a couple of minutes now to tell the world why you weren't present in week one and whether or not you regret it.
So, side note, I have seen Mamma Mia as well. But this time it was my mum's 60th birthday. She won't like me saying that out loud. So we had a little weekend to London with extended family. To see one of the things was to see ABBA Voyage. Now, this is basically, it's got, the reviews are unreal, the show was unreal, but it's essentially holograms, and you're sort of looking at the stage as if it's a normal concert. And yeah, it looks like they're actually in front of you in like their younger selves, but they're obviously not. But yeah, it's an amazing show. And as I said to you in person, I would recommend it. Have recommended it to a few people, but what we have established from Nottingham is that the winner does take it all.
Very good. But I'll give you that one.
That doesn't sound very regretful, does it?
No, I was so you're not regretting
really, no,
that at
report.
All. If we went back in time, Scott, you'd do it again.
Oh, my mother wouldn't have let me change that decision. So yes, okay. I would do it.
All right.
I liked it because actually, when I made the final, I overtook Scott in the rankings.
Ah, there you go.
That was good. He was always ranked a little bit above me. So as soon as I made the final, I checked. I was a few points above. I was like, right.
Yeah, you know.
There we go. So you know, I don't mention it very often. So
yeah, it's just brilliant for Marcus. Isn't it? It's absolutely terrific stuff.
Big win for Willis there. So that was ABBA. Marcus had a little bit more drama in week three because he didn't make this flight. Where you were going to play French League, is that right? Is that what the plan was at the weekend?
Yeah, going to play French League. I've done it every year apart from COVID for 12 years. So French League, yeah, you get paid to go and play for a team. It's financially very rewarding, and obviously you get matches as well. Yeah, I'm contracted to play a certain amount of matches, and that was one of them. And I booked a Saturday night flight, 8:20 Stansted. So normally in Britain, you're very easily going to make that. because a lot of the finals were on Fridays. Now this I knew was a Saturday. Yeah, a bit of a frustrating day. See, I mean, it rained in the morning. It didn't really rain. It was like dripping, and then they were coming off, going on, and then by the time we got indoors, it was a little bit later, and then on the way to Stansted, we had a bit of a clear run on the motorway. There wasn't much motorway, but then it started hammering it down with rain, so we could only go 40 miles an hour. I ended up missing the flight by 4 minutes, so I got to the desk and said, am I too late? And they said, for what? And I said, for Marseille. And they said, when's it taking off? I said, just under half an hour. They were like, yeah, no chance. Because I had a bag as well. So then I had 8 minutes to get a train into London, because that was the last train to get back to Warwick at about just before midnight. So I had quite a dramatic day in Nottingham, actually.
Yeah, that seems. Has that often happened? Have you ever been much in the situation where you've missed flights in your career? Because there's a lot of jetting.
I think I've missed. That's my second flight I've ever missed.
Wow.
Well, the other one was years ago, flying to a German league match, and I actually checked in and was waiting by the gate. And when I went to the gate, the guy said, "No, this is the flight to Italy, not Cologne." So then I went and sat down, got back to the start of the next queue, and he said, "You missed it."
No way.
Yeah, fuming. I was really fuming, because, and he sort of denied that he ever said that to me, because I had my boarding pass out. Basically sleep at Gatwick, I think it was, at Costa on the sofa until 4 a.m. and get to Germany somehow. But yeah, that was a pain. But second time in my life, I think I've ever missed a flight. Obviously, I've had some cancelled, but I'm not used to it. It's not a great feeling, to be honest.
Yeah, I missed one the same way. I was sat by the gate, and it was an American guy I was playing doubles with at the time. This was a few years ago, Connor Berg, and yeah, we got through security, sat by the gate. Next thing we know, the flight was gone, and they claimed that they'd said our names and all sorts, and we were sitting there like watching, like nobody got on, nobody got off, like we don't know what happened, but yeah, missed it.
That's a shambles, that one. You can't, if you're sat there, you can't miss it being shouted over the speaker.
I got in my queue and went to the front and showed him my boarding pass, and he said, no, we're doing the flight before, basically. And then when I got up, when that queue had gone, he said, you've missed it. Because I knew it was time to fly, pretty much. And then, yeah, he said, I never said that. I would have just let you on. I was like, what? So it was very confusing, But this one I kind of knew with an hour to go, if we couldn't get our foot on the gas, then it wasn't going to happen. And then, as I said, it was torrential rain, so we were sort of aquaplaning everywhere. And I said to the guy, don't worry about it. Because when I got in the Uber originally, I said that I've got 2 hours to get to Stansted. All right, go for it, but safely.
Pedal down.
Pretty nice guy, but when it started getting dangerous, I said, look, it's fine, don't worry about it. Just try and survive. Number one priority, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's good you can have that perspective. I mean, the only thing I could minorly relate on is the time one day I was coming home from uni a few years back, and I got onto the station platform and the train doors were open, but they wouldn't let me get on the train because they said it was time for the train to leave. The 20 seconds I spent arguing with them, I could have got on that train, but they wouldn't let me on. Yeah, which is... confusing, right? But not a flight to a tournament, so I'm pretty well off there, I've got to say. I thought maybe you'd be able to kind of persuade them with the tennis bag, you know, big tennis pro here, but they're not buying that, which is a...
They didn't know who I was. It was, yeah, it's very strange.
Well, that's tough, isn't it? Considering you played Roger Federer on centre court at Wimbledon.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly, unbelievable, these guys.
We're going to talk about that very briefly, because I want to do a little bit of background on the two of you, just so people kind of know who they're listening to. We won't go deep here, because obviously then it's a lot of the other person kind of sat waiting. By the way, this is the first time on the podcast we've had a doubles team on at the same time. We've had Lissy and Liv, and we've had Henry and Julian, but both times they did it separately. So you're making a podcast first here, so... Let's start with Marcus. You've done like a million podcasts at this point. I think you even had your own podcast, didn't you, for a while?
Yeah.
When was that?
Yeah, we've done a few seasons. I think at some point we'll do it again.
Nice.
But yeah, there's a backlog. There's a backlog. We've had a few people on: John Lloyd, Pat Cash, people like that. So.
Brilliant, and you've. Characters. Yeah, for sure. And you've guested on a lot of podcasts, and I know you've kind of covered a lot of ground, not just in kind of your. professional career, but also kind of personal life and kind of mental health issues and all of these kinds of things. But I'm sure that one thing that comes up every single time is that Wimbledon run in 2016 when you came through qualifying, you played Federer in round two. Does it ever get wearying being asked about this?
No, I mean, most people who ask me are massive tennis fans, so it's fine. You can explain it to them. They've got some understanding. It's sometimes you're at a random event and someone who doesn't really know too much says, what was it like playing Roger Federer? And I'm kind of like, well, what do you mean? What aspect? Because obviously there's so much to it. Just saying, what was it like is a very sort of bland, yeah, it was good. No, it was bad. Like, what? Where do you go with that? So, you know, I get asked it a lot, but it's pretty cool. I mean, I can't really complain. It's when I was growing up as a kid, it's what you dream of. So I'm very happy to talk about it. I'm very, very proud that I got there. But in the same way, yeah, I mean, it gets repetitive. But as I said, I'm happy to talk about it because each person who asks me is a different person and they'll have something different about them or find something interesting that's different to the person before. So no, yes and no, I suppose.
Okay, that's a really nice way of looking at it. I mean, you'll know just from Nottingham, but one of my personal favourite ones these days is to throw out the fact that you beat Andre Rublev and Daniil Medvedev back-to-back in qualifying, which sounds incredibly impressive now. But there's also the next year, so 2017, you and Jay Clark took out Nicolas Mahut and Pierre-Hugues Herbert, who were the defending champions in round two. I remember that one more vividly, I think, than any of the others. Does anyone ever ask you about that occasion? Because that was still a big court.
Yeah, I mean, it was court three, middle Saturday, second round, and we won in five. And it was, yeah, one of the best atmospheres I've ever played in. Because I think it was one of the last matches of the day. Everyone had a few drinks in them, and it was quite a Davis Cup atmosphere. There was a lot of chanting going on. And obviously, we lost the first set, it was kind of, in my head, I was like, I want to make this competitive. I want to see if we can sneak a set or, you know, just make it hard work for them at that stage. Because, you know, of course you believe you can win. You don't turn up and to lose. But I believe probably 2%, 5% we could win. I wasn't thinking, oh, this is a 50-50. We've got a good shot here. I was thinking, you know, maybe if we play really well, they have a poor match, things go our way, then it can happen. And that's pretty much what did happen. But no, people don't ask as much about that. And for me, that's probably the biggest win in my career. I mean, Rublev and Medvedev were good. And from a personal note, the run in 2016 was better for me, but actually in terms of upsets, being those guys who were very, very good. So for me, that was unbelievable. And I, like, when we won that, I was euphoric. It was amazing.
Yeah, they were, and I mean, I guess still are to an extent in recent years, one of the best doubles teams going in terms of consistency, being like slam winners, going deep at slams. So yeah, that was a massive win. So now I move to your current doubles partner, Scott. Scott, you took a little bit of a different road, I guess, onto the circuit because you were at uni, you were at Stirling Uni in Scotland, which is becoming a more popular base, I think, in recent times for players who are looking at going pro. At the time you were there, what was the pathway like in terms of going on to play professionally afterwards? I know Johnny O'Mara was there at one point, but was there much background with players that had actually moved on to the ITF circuit afterwards?
So it was mainly Colin Fleming was the guy who went to Stirling, and then I think he made 13 in the world doubles, which is obviously pretty good. Yeah, so there was him, and there was, I mean, sort of lower down guys like Keith Meisner. I don't know if you know, I think he got a few points. Yeah, Keith with his guitar.
Good to see.
Yeah, he is, yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there was a few guys, but mainly Flambo. And it was one of the things I sort of came into uni and said to Ewan McGinn, who was the coach at the uni at the time and is still my coach now. I just said, yeah, I wanted to sort of get as good as possible and try to play professional tennis. And he was really good. He spent a lot of time with me and, yeah, helped me sort of build into the player that I am now. And, yeah, so I did a four-year undergrad, which is normal in Scotland, and then I did a sort of part-time master's. Like, I did it over 4 years just basically to continue to play, to continue to sort of grow my game, because if I was in the uni system, I was getting my training paid for, I was getting some additional scholarship stuff, like Justin Taylor Foundation. Justin Taylor was a student at Stirling and gives a scholarship now to help sort of athletes on their journey. I was on winning students scholarship. And yeah, all that just sort of helped me fund a little bit the journey that I took.
Awesome. So you were there at Stirling for quite a while. Now, George Howson, yeah. Okay. He was at Loughborough Uni for a while. I heard he got a court named after him. Did you get any kind of honouring like that? A court named after you? A statue, some kind of monument to commemorate your time at Stirling? Did you get that treatment or not?
Unfortunately, no. I always thought that I'd get a statue, but it never seemed to happen. So, you know, there's still time yet, though.
It's tough out here. Hey, maybe they'll listen to this and kind of start thinking about it. We'll see. Particularly if you guys continue on the trajectory that you're on. So let's talk about that now. You started playing together, I think, last season. But Marcus, you'd had a doubles focus kind of prior to that. So did you ever officially retire? Was that kind of end of 2020, beginning of 2021? Did you actually say that is it for me?
No, I did. Yeah, I mean, I couldn't really afford to play anymore. Obviously, I've got a young family, so it was a case of if I was going to play, it'd be a few tournaments a year. It'd be quite scrappy and not making a whole lot of money. So yeah, I was done. I didn't want to retire, but I couldn't see any other way. There was no other option. And then I was playing an exhibition event at the end of 2021, and my now current sponsor was watching me play. I always used to go to David Lloyd and. My friend used to coach his daughter, so I used to sort of hit in and give her some tips. And he saw me play this exhibition event and said, look, my company's doing really well. I can sponsor you to go back on tour. And obviously I said, yeah, that would be fantastic. Thank you very much. But in the back of my head, I kind of went home and was like, I had to really think, do I want to do this again? Because I know what it's like. It's tough out there, you know, when you're starting out, no points. So obviously I'd lost my ranking and I had to go and get in shape because I was significantly heavier than I am now. So it took a lot of work and I started in my first tournament was Roehampton in July. I got in as an alternate, got a win there. So we got 3 points, which got me on the ranking board 2 weeks later. And then from there, I think I played with 6 different people in my first 7 tournaments.
He's missed out who he beat.
I beat Scott in the first round. I don't want to keep harping on about it.
That's really nice of him to point that out. He didn't have to do that.
No, I know. I've mentioned it loads of times. It's become a bit of a joke. But like, yeah. So I actually beat Scott and Ben Jones in our first match, me and Whitehouse.
Okay.
We got in third alternates because the other two alternates who signed in went home. I was on court training and I got a text saying, you're in. So we had to then rush. Get changed, go on court, play. And then, yeah, we won that match, got me on the ranking board. And then, as I said, yeah, I played with 6 different guys in the first 7 tournaments because I wasn't exactly, you know, the most popular guy to play with being unranked or, you know, 2,000 in the world. So, yeah, I played with 6 different guys, played with McKinley 1 week, made a final. And I think I spoke to Scott at Roehampton before we even played, saying sort of, you know, I'm looking for a regular partner. And Scott's coach actually said Scott doesn't have anyone regular and stuff like that. So I played with McKinley in France, and McKinley's a bit of a space cadet. So I thought I'd agreed to play 2 in a row in France with him. And halfway through the first one, when I was talking about travel to the next place, he goes, oh yeah, sorry, I've got Highland Games. I can't play next week. So I'm there.
Why does that not surprise me at all?
I sent Scott a message saying, you know, do you want to sign in Madrid next week? Because it's on hard. I don't know why we said Madrid. I think he was in Portugal. So yeah, it was just easier for us to get to. And so we signed in there. We won the tournament. And then I said, do you want to play the next 2 in France in October? I think I played with someone else in between. Because we hadn't agreed. And I said, do you want to play these 2 in France together? We'll do 2 in France and then and 2 in Greece. And we won the 2 in France, went to Greece, got a few points there. And then since there, it's been like, hey, we're going to be a regular partnership. Then obviously I did my ankle in November. Scott went to Sharm el-Sheikh and made a final and 1-1. So he then went above me in the rankings. As we've discussed previously, I've now caught him. yeah, We started in January and I couldn't play Loughborough because my ankle wasn't right. I probably shouldn't have played Sheffield because in hindsight I was still in a bit of pain, but we won that. We won Sheffield and then won Bath 2 weeks later. So, and then obviously just won Nottingham, a couple of Challenger quarterfinals. So we've picked up quite a lot of points and we haven't actually had any coaching yet as well. So we've just been working it as we go. People have been watching our matches, giving us tips and stuff. But because we've been so focused on getting the ranking up and playing matches, which is our goal this time of year anyway, I still think we've got a lot to improve, which is exciting.
Yeah, for sure. It picks up points and picks up steam. You've really been getting going quickly as a team. Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned that because I was looking at your previous results, trying to work out when you kind of started the partnership officially. And it really confused me that the two of you had won this title the first time you played together and then split up for a while. I didn't know if you weren't Scottish enough for Scott or something. And that was why it hadn't come together quite as soon as it could have done. But
I think because I was so adamant on playing, I was setting up partners for each week and just obviously I didn't know if I was going to win with Scott or play well with Scott. So I just wanted to sort of play with everyone and see, get some information and see what I felt best with. Sure. Obviously, when we won Madrid without dropping a set, I thought that's a pretty good sign.
Definitely.
But I'd already arranged to play with, I think, Josh Paris in Sunderland. I can't remember if there was, and I think you played a couple with McKinley in France. I played with an Argentinian, actually, that week because he had agreed with McKinley for a couple. So I think we had already pre-arranged. And once you pre-arrange, you don't really want to say, oh, sorry, mate, I've just won with him. I'm not going to play with you anymore. So it was a case of, yeah, I think after Madrid, we thought, you know, we'd had our tournament plan sorted. It was a case of, when should we get on court together again? Because, yeah, as I say, before France, we'd already agreed to play four in a row. And I think by then, by the time we won the first France, it was very much a partnership, official.
Official, stamped on it. Yeah, you don't want to ruin your reputation, do you, by pulling out of something you've agreed to? Because in the event Scott dumps you, you don't want to like limit your options of who you could actually go back to and play with. So,
Yeah,
been smart there. Right, Scott, you were still playing singles semi-regularly last season. If I'm correct, you haven't played any singles at all this year, correct? Or not?
I've not played any singles this year.
Okay, so what's the plan? Have you fully committed to the doubles thing now, or is kind of singles still in mind?
To be honest, since COVID, the doubles has sort of been... I was kind of looking to make a transition more just to play doubles more and almost doubles only. I suppose when things kicked off again, I still had ATP singles points. So sort of the opportunity was there. I was doing that. I didn't really have a regular partner. I played some with Johnny Binding, but Johnny was then going back to uni and I kind of wasn't really sure what was going on. So I think... as of the start of 2022, like I played a few singles here and there. I don't think I played a whole lot last year, but I think my last match, like I managed to pick up another point, I think in April time, but the last match I think was August in Sunderland, I think it was. And just because I still had the points.
October was Sunderland, yeah. You played Vasa. They're like, you played Madrid and you played that guy and you puffed out.
Puffed out, did I?
Yeah, you were toast.
Was I?
Do you remember?
No.
No, okay.
Come on, bring the story. We need the story. Come on.
Oh, I watched him play in Madrid and it was quite hot.
He won
Love and Love first round qualities and was like, I'm quite tired after that. that's when I thought, yeah.
that was when you decided,
it was
okay.
Hot, to be fair.
Yeah, if he's done after Love and Love, he probably needs a partner on court to kind of take half the load. Is that that's the assumption here? Brilliant. Yeah. Okay. It's good to know where we're at, guys. Good to know. Okay, so we're.
long story short, yeah, I am doubles only now. That was in the goal for a while, to be honest. Yeah.
Okay, and now you've found a reliable partnership in which you have the safety to go doubles only, I guess, which is, that's good.
And I think it helps, well, just like when we're trying to make the jump to challengers, like if I found it difficult before when playing with somebody, I played with a Czech guy, Dominic Kolovsky, and he was very much focused on his singles still, and then it just makes it difficult because then he was still trying to get into qualies in some places, and then you've kind of got to watch the lists for qualies, and the singles list might be weaker than the doubles list, or you know, all that sort of stuff.
Sure.
Whereas now we can kind of, because neither of us is playing the singles, we don't need to get somewhere by the weekend. We can take our time, look at the lists, and then choose the right places to go, like schedule smart. And now we're trying to make the jump into challengers as well. If one of us was in the singles of a futures, that wouldn't be possible.
Yeah, logistically, the tennis tours can be so tough. So to be on the same page with that, it just makes it that little bit easier. So great how that's worked out for the two of you. Okay, so guys, you've spoken about kind of at the moment trying to make that move up to the challenger circuit. Both your doubles rankings are climbing. Obviously, there's that all-important 10 spots between them at the moment that Marcus is loving currently. But you're making a steady climb, doing good stuff. The future circuit, are you enjoying it, or have you seen enough of it? Because the two of you have been around it now, I guess, for a fair while, and Marcus having played singles previously as well and having been around for some time. Some players just don't want to stick it out on that circuit. And so with the results you're having at the moment and how tough it is to get into certain doubles draws right now, is it frustrating, or can you kind of enjoy the grind, as it were, at the moment?
It is what it is. So we're entering challenges. It's just if we get in or not. And for some reason, the points from week one in Nottingham have taken 3 weeks to go on. And last week's points and this week's points, I don't know when they're going to go on. So we're entering challenges with our combined of 530 or something, and actually we're 470 in the live ranking. So we missed out last week by one place again. We've done that three times in a row now to enter the challenges. So it's just we're trying. It's just a case of being patient. And, you know, when our points go on, we'll be in a lot more challenges. So futures are fine. As you say, I'm very used to them. It's just a case of we want to play challenges and test our game. And I think we'll know more about what we've got to improve at that level. Saying that at future, especially in the UK, there's a lot of strong doubles partnerships. So they're not easy. Apart from yesterday, we've always had a difficult match. It's always been challenging. So it's not like, you know, we have won a lot, but we've played well. But yeah, I'm ready. I'm looking forward to the, you know, hopefully to the day where, you know, I play challenges every week. We play challenges every week.
So that's the goal right now.
Okay, it's just nice. So you get a hotel booked for you, you get everything's more organised, you don't have to do so much yourself, rather than you just focus, you just turn up, book your practice court and play. Whereas here we're looking at, you know, Airbnbs, how far is it from the club, flights, you know, dinners, everything at challenger level's pretty much done for you. Much, you know, better points, better organised, and you feel like a player, it's an event. Whereas, I know, you've been to quite a few futures as well, and you know there's not a whole lot of people there, right? It's not, you know, it's kind of a bit of a, I don't know the word to describe it,
but vibeless.
It's vibeless. Your players and coaches are there, and you know, you get a few tennis fans. Nottingham wasn't too bad, but yeah, most of us playing in front of, especially in the UK, you're playing in front of no people, so it's nice when you play challengers. There's a crowd there. There's, you know, people pay to go and watch. In Croatia, they were selling tickets to go and watch. So it's just where we want to be.
Sure.
When I was young, I didn't envisage playing in front of no people in the middle of a field in Nottingham. That you know, but it's something you've got to do. And you know, the level's good. It's not like you're playing in a field in the middle of Nottingham and it's rubbish tennis. It's challenging. And that's just the brutality of the Futures Tour, I think. I think the level's pretty good, and a lot of people don't get out of it because it's strong. But if you can get yourself into challenges and, you know, win a few matches at that level, all the points take care of your ranking, and, you know, you don't actually have to, once you're sort of 150 to 200 in the world, you don't have to win that many matches to maintain your ranking. You have to have a few good weeks a year, whereas Futures, we've, how many have we won? Six together
Yeah, six trophies as a team.
I've won seven. I've made four or five finals, and I'm at 230-ish in the world when my ranking goes on. So I think if you do that much winning at challenges, you're a lot higher. We're looking forward to it. We're looking forward to hopefully getting to a ranking where, you know, we play futures some weeks if it's convenient, or, you know, there's not any challenges on, and that's the goal really. Yeah. For the near future.
This is your reminder, everyone listening, that ITF events in the UK are free entry. So I was actually very nicely surprised by some of the people that came a distance to watch in Nottingham. Don't get me wrong, there were not crowds, but that's an open invitation. And I still get people messaging me saying, is it free entry? Which is, to me, I'm putting that out there a lot. So I thought maybe we need to put that out there even more so that people are actually aware. Because like you say, with the challenges, the level... maybe not hugely dissimilar, but in terms of the branding and the promotion of the event, it's poles apart, and it's about kind of the effort that goes in on that side. So I think like I and others probably all need to do a better job in terms of advertising that and putting that out there. But you said it, Marcus, that the level there is good, and you've got some strong, particularly British teams at the moment. So I wonder for the two of you, grass court season is coming up. We have to touch on this. And as we've seen with Marcus previously playing at Wimbledon, there are some big prizes up for grabs, I guess, and rewards for promising results, title runs. How much were you thinking about that in terms of during Nottingham as you were playing as a team? And obviously there are other Brits who are forming partnerships looking for those opportunities. How much are you thinking about that between matches? How much are you thinking about that during matches?
Well, obviously you notice it, and it's part of the job. I always try and say we just focus on ourselves and try and win the match ahead of us, and sort of things will, you know, look after themselves. And we're not in control of wildcards. So I think what we've done and what we continue to do and what we've been doing is, you know, giving ourselves every chance. We've done a lot of winning. I think we've only lost to one British pair in our time together. We've beaten a lot of different combinations of Brits. And also, we've won a lot of matches in general. So I think our rankings are good. Our, you know, head-to-head record is good against Brits. Our performances are good. So I think that's all we can do. Looking up to the grass. Of course, we've got one eye on it, and you know, it'd be nice to know sort of the criteria, what they're looking for wildcards. But in the same way, it's not the end of the world if we do or don't get opportunities. It's, you know, bottom line, we're going to be 470 combined going into the summer. I'm not defending anything until September. We've got a good chance to get our ranking, you know, really high, and play challenges every week. So. Of course, we've got one eye on it. Of course, we think about it. And it's interesting to see, you know, different Brits pair up with each other. And you don't really know what, you know, what everyone's plan is. But we know what our plan is. And that's nice. I mean, I think we're the only pair that have played together fully since the end of last year. And that's a lot nicer for us than sort of having to find, you know, a Brit last minute to, try and get some wildcards to the grass court.
Yeah, definitely. I think there'll be a fair few Brits that don't even need wildcards this year, such as the standard of doubles within British tennis at the moment. Scott, I wonder if that had any or much impact on you. You said you wanted to kind of go doubles only anyway, but was it encouraging to see, I guess, the players higher up the rankings, Neil Skupski, Joe Salisbury, all of these guys who are going doubles only and having a lot of success with it?
Yeah, of course. I mean, obviously everybody's heard about Louis Caille and his system of doing things and stuff like that, and he's obviously got a system that's worked like multiple times over. So yeah, like the guys at the top are obviously sort of showing us the way. So it's our job just to try and sort of match sort of what they're doing. But yeah, it's encouraging for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And you've kind of touched on the fact that it's almost a little bit tough to be a doubles-only player at the moment because it's so tough to get into some of these draws higher up the rankings, a tournament that you might be able to get into on a singles ranking of your level. Your doubles ranking might not be sufficient just because it's so, I don't know, the draws are kind of carnage these days. So in terms of for you two moving up to that challenger level, Do you think, because you've played some challenges this year and won some challenger matches, do you think much needs to change in terms of your game in order to get there consistently? Or is it literally just a case of your numbers qualifying you for those draws and then you feel you can do some damage?
Yeah, look, I think we're going to have to work on a few things. But I think if we do what we've been doing already, if we do what we've been doing well, we're going to be very tough to be at any level. So yeah, there'll be some tweaking. And I think if we're regular challenger players, we're going to have to take a couple more weeks to do some training with a coach more than we have been doing. But I'm confident that, you know, if we were thrown into every challenger now, I don't think we'd be embarrassed every week. And I think we'd be pleasantly surprised how well we'd do. So I think we've got good games already. Obviously, I've played quite a few challenges before, you know, my latest comeback. And I've, you know, I made a final with Burt's years ago in America. I've made quite a few semi-finals. I haven't won one yet, but obviously had my run at Wimbledon. So yeah, we'll have to do some tweaks for sure. But I'm confident that, you know, once we get in, we don't have to. I don't think we should panic and change too much if we lose a couple of matches. That's basically what I'm saying.
Yeah, I think it's like acclimatizing as well. Like, we're both so used to, as he said, he's played sort of more challengers than me, but we're so used to kind of everything that happens on, like, playing the futures, and it's then just going into a different environment. Whereas you say, there's maybe a bit more people watching. There's branding everywhere. There's things are made a little bit easier, and it's just different. So it's I think getting to a place where that becomes like your normal, and then you can just sort of go and do what you do, which is what I feel we obviously have in the future, where we can just, like, I feel like we turn up and we just know what's going on. So it's just a bit more, yeah, just acclimatizing, I think. Does that make sense?
Yeah, we just need to get used to playing in these events more often. And I think, yeah, you know, we've done all right already. We've had a couple of good wins. We've had one tight loss. It's not like we haven't been embarrassed once, actually. So, yeah, it's just getting used to the Challenger Tour a little bit. I think that's. I mean, like it was when I first started playing Futures. You know, I didn't win straight away. I made a quarters. I made a semis. I didn't win until end of September, and I started in July. So it could be the same for Challengers. It might take us a while to get into it. It might not. But yeah, just got to be ready. And as he says, it becomes a new norm.
Sure. We'll wrap this up shortly. Just a couple more things. You make a really good point about being comfortable, and when you're kind of relaxed in the environment, then you can play your best. How comfortable at this point are you in each other's company? Because it's a full-time partnership now, so you're kind of always together. I imagine that when you're on the road, there's this whole situation of, I don't know, sharing rooms and stuff to cut down on costs and that kind of thing. So basically, have you got fed up of each other yet, or is it going okay?
No, we get on very well. It's nice. And it's important for doubles, right? Like, we get on very well. He hasn't annoyed me yet. Maybe you have to ask him the same question.
Come on then, Scott.
But no, we get on well. We got a similar sense of humour, and I think we like similar things, don't we?
Yeah. As you say, it makes everything a whole lot easier when you do get on, both on and off court. Like, we're currently in our chateau.
It's a hammock here.
I saw that room. So you gotta be used to sort of living in close quarters, and yeah, as he says, we like the same things and stuff like that. So yeah, it just makes it pretty easy.
Did you actually sleep on that hammock, Marcus, or not?
No, I've got a little. It's not little. It's a double bed pull up thing. But okay. I did. I have climbed on it a couple of times. I can safely say I'm more accustomed to it now. I've got used to it.
Okay, so acclimatized to the hammock, and hopefully acclimatized to the Challenger circuit within the near future. But last question, guys, how much do you talk about, obviously there's a lot of short-term planning, talking about maybe working with a coach in the near future, where you want to get to on the tour. How far do you look ahead as a team? Have you had those conversations?
Yeah, we've looked until the end of this year, and we haven't set any, I don't think we've set any, you know, ranking goals concrete as of yet. because, yeah, I mean, the ranking goals I set myself already and we've set ourselves, we've smashed already. So it's just a case of seeing where we're at with rankings, see where at the end of this year, see if we can get a one next to our name, be in the ones, be a regular challenger player in it, and then go from there. But I never look too far ahead. Because it's easy to get carried away and we don't know what's going to happen. We still don't know what's going to happen until, you know, now and 2 months' time. So it's important to have, you know, short-term goals and maybe look at the year ahead. But I'll never look any further than that.
Scott, are you on the same page?
Yeah, we've had that discussion. We've sort of had a look at tournaments. We're sort of always looking at the calendar and had a little sort of chat about maybe like swings that we could do, like a US swing or somewhere else. So we've kind of spoken up until the end of the year, and then we'll see what happens. We're going to be defending a few points coming up to the end of the year. So yeah, it's sort of, as Marcus says, we want to be in the ones, and then sort of try to kick on from there.
Six titles and counting. It's been great to see. I really enjoyed watching you last week in Nottingham and hope to see you back on British soil in the near future. So Marcus and Scott, thank you very much for taking quite some time for this. I appreciate it, and all the best for the next few weeks.
Thanks, Abigail.
Thanks very much.
See you soon.
Yeah, see you soon.
Events on the first rungs of the pro tennis ladder can be lacking in atmosphere, but Marcus and Scott brought high levels of entertainment to Nottingham and to the podcast just now, so many thanks to them for that. Now, the grass court season is less than a month away, but there is still more tennis action to come in the UK prior to that, including the sixth week of this year's UK Pro League, which is currently underway in Aldershot. You can find live streams and results for that at ukproleague.com. And you can find the podcast on Instagram at tennis_in_the_UK and on Twitter at tennis_in_the_UK. You can also find myself on both platforms at Abigail Tennis, and I'm sure back on the mic here next week. So thank you for listening, and see you then.